Hello, it is me, Ronald, and we are back with another episode of the Arama Japan podcast. We are covering the month of March 2022 this episode, and I am joined tonight by my usual co-host, Hannah.
Hello.
And we have a returning guest. Introduce yourself, special guest.
Oh, me? Hi, I'm Tim. How long has it been since I was last on the show?
It was, I think, the end of 2020, because you were on for part of our female soloist special, part yes. one, the new school ones.
I can't believe it's been that long ago already.
Yeah,
you know, I was really sick that episode. And then yeah. as soon as it finished, I like turned it off and then like went and was very violently ill for like an hour.
Oh no.
Oh, God. Well, we have Tim here tonight because we are going to talk about probably the biggest Japanese, internationally at least, the biggest Japanese entertainment news story of March, which would have been Drive My Car. So for those who do not know, the movie was nominated for 4 Oscars, Best Film, Best Foreign Language Film, Best Director, and Best Adapted Screenplay. It won the most obvious category it would win, which was Best International Film. So, what did you two think of the film?
So, you know how when Western cities have Japanese film festivals and then the film festival lineup is always like art house, something like mm-hmm. quaint mm-hmm. about like making mochi in a village. And then there's always like one really big movie that is like bereft of all artistic content, but the lead actor in it is like a Johnny's or something, so the entire crowd is just like fans of that Johnny's. I only really mm-hmm. went to watch Drive My Car because I like the lead actor
for good reason.
Yes, we love Nishijima. I'd actually sat on going to I'd kind of delayed put off going to watch it for ages because there was a link. Like it's watchable online now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, I can just watch it online. But the thing is, it's like 3 hours long. And if I watch it at home, it means I will fall asleep during the middle of it. Whereas I know if I watch it in a cinema, I'm forced to like be attentive for the entire 3 hours. Yeah, it was like, what did you think of it first, Ronald? Because I know you've actually sat down and thought about your thoughts on this.
So the thing is, though, is that going into it, people were talking about how it was such like a quiet film and how it deals with like a lot of like space and use of silence and use of like time in the movie. But I didn't really feel that. I will admit that like the first half an hour, it was kind of hard for me to get into the vibe of it. But like after that first half an hour, pretty much for those who do not haven't watched the movie, basically the first 40 minutes is just like playing, and then you get the opening credits like 40 minutes into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Once the opening credits started, I was into it and I watched the whole thing through.
The thing with Drive My Car is that for better or for worse, it's actually not just like, you know how in past Murakami adaptations, because it's an adaptation of a Haruki Murakami short story. In past adaptations, like Norwegian Wood and stuff, it's pretty much just a straight down the lines. Like, this is exactly what happened in the story without much variation. But Drive My Car is actually quite a loose adaptation of the Murakami story because it's not just one. Because it's not an adaptation just of the one short story it was based off of. It's actually an amalgamation of the different stories from that collection into the one story.
Interesting.
And that's why the first half of the story is like this 40-minute encapsulated, almost completely separate vignette from the rest of it. And that's why I feel that's kind of why there are these plot thread points that get picked up and then put down, or that aren't really directly linked with each other, because they're all different aspects from different short stories amalgamated into the one movie.
Got it.
And I think because it's a loose adaptation, it works to its advantage and just to its disadvantage, because disadvantage speaking, it makes the plot line, it makes the messaging a little bit hazy, but on the other hand, it means that it disposes away with some of the more egregious tropes found in Haruki Murakami texts, because it is a more loose adaptation. It takes like the basic concepts and then it kind of spins it off into its own messaging. Like, for example, the sections with the driver, with the female chauffeur, a lot of that I don't think was in the original story, in the original stories. And I think that's quite interesting because, as Hannah has mentioned, like outside of the podcast, like as Hannah has mentioned privately, you know, Murakami texts suffer from like really wooden female characters. Like pretty much they do not exist in any meaningful way other than to fuel the male plot lines forward. And usually only through like one of them dying or one of them having like a very severe condition of some sort. I thought it was interesting because the stronger parts of the female portrayals and plot lines in Drive My Car seem to be the ones that Hamaguchi, the director himself, has... Or look, did he write the screenplay?
I think so. Oh, yes, he co-wrote it.
So the parts where I was like, oh, these are strong female portrayals, but also like sections that weren't from the original story. Like the deaf actress and the driver, those were the parts that were like less Murakami in that they were, you know, fleshed out characters, and also they were characters that were not fleshed out like that in the original story.
Did you read the original story it was based on?
I read just the Drive My Car story. So the original story is just like the driving part, right? Okay. Like pretty much that's it. We're spoiling this, right?
Basically the adultery angle was like a completely different story that was added in.
It was not quite, as in the adultery angle was there, but it was just kind of like the short story was basically just the exchanges between the driver and the actor.
Okay.
So all of the things like bits and pieces like the, and then she tells me stories every time we have sex. And then she makes it, that wasn't in the original one. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the Uncle Vanya stuff was like pretty much not in the story at all. Those were all like original things. It basically just took like the core concept. I remember the concepts that stayed the same were the driving and the conclusion at the end where she was like, well, maybe she wasn't cheating on you because she didn't like you. Maybe she was just cheating on you because that was her part of her. That was just her sort of conclusion at the end of the movie. But the it's not... The most Murakami part of the movie is the first 40 minutes. Which makes sense. Because that's like women as wallpaper section.
Yeah.
Of the
movie. Yeah.
Hannah, what did you think of the movie?
Literally... Okay, so I'm going to be honest. I knew it was a Murakami film, and that was an immediate turnoff. I've read some of his books. I suffered through them, is what I like to put it. He gets a lot of advantage from the fact that he benefits a lot from the fact that there are translators out there who really, really love his work. And therefore work very, very hard to make it extremely amazing in whatever language they're translating to, right?
Mm-hmm.
So English is one of those languages, which is why he has such a big fan base here. And one of the things that tends to get glossed over a lot is just the fact that like Murakami basically thinks of women as sex objects and cannot think outside of that paradigm. Like,
well, a great example would be where basically the wife's entire role in the movie is just like sex object, and basically her whole creative process for writing is linked to her having sex.
Yeah, exactly. And as soon as I read that in the synopsis, I was like, I'm done. Goodbye. Right? And I actually skipped over those parts when I was like skimming through the movie, right? In order to review it for this, because I really hated it. And like I was mentioning to everyone prior to this conversation, another thing that really, really ticks me off about Murakami, and I'm not sure if Hamaguchi does this, I really want to explore his other work because he just did such an amazing job with such a limited scope of things, right? Is mm-hmm. that Murakami has a tendency to like invent mental illnesses that only happen to affect women.
So speaking of that, Tim, the mental illness that's presented in the driver's mother at the end of the movie, what did you think of that?
Well, sort of to touch on what Hannah said, I think this is where we have to remember that Drive My Car is work based on the Murakami book, but is very much a Hamaguchi work in and of itself. Because, you know, even though it's true that in the film, the mother of the driver, who is unshown for most of it and has most of her backstory exposed through the dialogue between the characters, and she does, you know, suffer from a typically like Murakami mysterious mental illness that isn't like named and is sort of like fueling forward the characters. But do we still count? Does it still count as a failure of the Bechdel test if that's used to fuel forward another female character's story? What do you think?
I think so. My issue with it is that this like mysterious mental illness that just kind of comes out of nowhere and is used. It's a convenient plot point that fundamentally, like, it doesn't fail the Bechdel test at all. I actually think it passes it with flying colors, which I think is to Hamaguchi's credit.
Can you explain what that test is?
So it's basically you have two female characters that talk to each other in a movie somehow, right? And if they're not talking about a man, usually in a romantic capacity, although sometimes I've seen people expand it to like a family capacity, it passes the Bechdel test. And somebody actually invented a second variant of this test called the Rinko test, based on the Pacific Rim character. That's basically like, if you have a female character, even if she doesn't talk to other female characters, if she has her own independent storyline that is not dependent on a man, but like completely drives forward the plot in a very meaningful way that is non-romantic, that too can be considered a type of like success in female portrayals. And on both fronts, this film obviously passes, right?
Yes. And
I also think of like the scene and when they're doing the rehearsal, the scene between the Taiwanese actress and the Korean actress.
And also and like the
kind of just like what was wife, that in the play?
Yeah, the deaf wife trying to communicate with the driver. If you guys remember those scenes, like yes. I thought it was very interesting that like both of the major contenders for adopted script for this year's Oscars were like based on very, very deaf actors playing like deaf characters playing extremely pivotal roles, right? Because that's when I was like, oh, the communication aspect of this one is going to be super important then, right? So I was just going to say, like, long story short, I think they invented a mental illness to just get around the fact that like the mother, because of her short time on screen, they needed a convenient way to expose her inner monologue by inventing a mental illness, right? And on one hand, I'm just like, oh, that's convenient. On the other hand, I'm like, you're operating in a Japanese context and I don't know how this makes me feel.
It was kind of different. Oh, she's a bad mother because she's mentally ill. Or she's mentally ill, so that makes her a bad mother. Something like that.
Well, I mean, if you compare it to other Murakami novels and other Murakami works, when we talk about the invented illness, it doesn't seem quite as egregious in this film as it would be typically. Like, in like it's an unnamed mental illness condition, but it is one that is realistic and it sort of works within the context of the things, whereas in other works such as Norwegian Wood's always the one that comes to mind, where it's really like, here is Manic Pixie Dream Girl only exists you know, to fuel forward your specific like man growth story. And also, not that I've seen them, but just to judge from Hamaguchi's past works, his other two films, one of which is like a female character only movie.
Is that Asako? Because like, okay,
no, so that's, it's Wheel of Fortune, something, something.
Wheel of Fortune.
And it's like, it's woman only. And then like women, WLW representation throughout. And then the other movie, Asako, is, it's the trope flipped on its head. It's the men as emotional wallpaper to fuel forward the female story film.
Nice.
Because in that one, the man is the manic pixie dream girl who disappears and comes back and is mysterious and doesn't make any sense.
A question I had about the movie was, I didn't get the end.
What about it? Didn't
you get the end? Yeah, I thought it was pretty. I thought it was pretty explicit for an art
like film. Like the end, like she like ends up taking his car and like moving to Korea.
Yes.
That okay, is exactly what happened. But like,
remember that she moves to Hiroshima to search for her dad.
Yeah.
So it's a symbolic abandonment of just this entire quest for biological parents and just saying, I'm going to uproot myself and let go of everything and move forward.
So why'd she take his car?
Because the car is a symbol of like his inability to move on from his dead wife.
Yeah.
That. So now that he doesn't have the, he doesn't need the car anymore, it's like, oh, it's how they showed like, here's the happily ever after for the actor without us having to explicitly show it to you.
So it's kind of like why he was able to play Uncle Vanya after going to the ruined house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically, like she just ups and moves to Korea. Why'd she move to Korea? I have a personal theory as to why she's in Korea, because do you guys know the backstory? Do you guys know the back? Now that we've like gone and talked about the actual film itself, now we got to talk about the backstory and everything related to the movie. So the fact is that
they had to pause production on this because of the fact that like COVID hit and they needed to film this film. But even though it was originally supposed to take place in Korea, which is why like half the cast is Korean.
I did not know that.
So it's like a symbolic
moving back.
Yeah. So the thing is, though, is that this was originally supposed to be, wasn't really supposed to be a theater production in Hiroshima. It was originally supposed to be the Busan International Film Festival. That the movie was
I would have much rather that came.
The thing is, a couple of the things here just like kind of don't make sense.
So I mean, it was cool. Like I could understand, like, you know, arty farty people would be like, yeah, let's create a whole production of Uncle Vanya where no one speaks the same language. And like someone's gonna speak in Tagalog and someone's gonna speak in Korean and somebody's gonna speak in Hokkien. And it's just, we're just gonna live subtitle the whole thing. Like within the context of like people in the arts, I was like, yeah, okay. I mean, I will suspend disbelief for this particular.
I was confused by it until I actually saw it. And I was just like, oh, wait a minute, Ronald, you've been to the opera. You should know how this goes. So the thing is, though, is that the film was originally supposed to be set in Korea at the Busan International Film Festival. But then COVID hit and they couldn't do it. But also, if you read the articles about the movie, one of the reasons why it was supposed to be in Korea was because Korea has a superior film production infrastructure compared to Japan, and Hamaguchi wanted to utilize that in this movie creation.
I am not surprised.
Mm-hmm. So,
you know, I was going to say there's new movies in Korea.
So the thing is, though, is that the movie has been gaining all this international attention, yet it has had little fanfare in Japan. It hasn't been a big seller in Japan. Most of the ticket sales for the movie came after it was nominated for the Oscar.
That just happened.
Is that surprising to you?
It's not surprising to me.
That's not surprising. That's not even like a Japanese thing. That's like a literally film thing in the world.
The reason why
Parasite was so popular beforehand, for example, to use an example of like another foreign film that got Oscar accolades, is because Parasite is infinitely a more instantly accessible film when you watch it.
Yeah.
So going back to like the articles I've been reading about this, one of the things, it's funny that Tim mentioned this earlier, but like one of the things that was talked about, how people were talking about, oh, this is like Japan returning to like, is Japan going to return to like the mid 20th century and like regain its place as like this great filmmaking country? And it was kind of just like, no, because most films in the country are not like Drive My Car. If anything, this isn't an indication of the Japanese industry. It's like an indictment of the industry, that the industry cannot make movies like this because basically it's too caught up in Jimushu politics of like getting Johnnies to like be stars of movies and like having like random manga adaptations of this and that, and like cosmetic companies investing money into production and like saying all these different stipulations that artists, directors and screenwriters can't have freedom in actually making films like Drive My Car. So basically a lot of the critics that were in Japan are kind of just like, yeah, this movie is okay, but it's not going to be like a trend here because like they didn't play the game that we play here. What did you two think about that?
I have opinions. Would you like to hear my opinion on that? I have an opinion.
Go.
So my opinion on that is that Japanese film is like pretty, I don't think it's actually gotten worse or better over the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. It's just the exposure of the good films is just not as high because Japan is not actively going around selling it to other countries. Because if you take, like, let's take the Korean film industry as a comparison. The movies that do the most well in that country are still not like art movies.
Yes.
Yeah, like, and no,
the I movie, was actually going to say the same exact thing.
Yeah, like the movies that sell the most to other countries are also still not the art movies. It's still exactly the same idols and popular actors in their main roles, extended commercials for CJ products and cosmetics and soft power related things. The only difference is that one country's film industry is a little bit more invested at pushing those quality films overseas than the others is. Because CJ itself, you know, Parasite was a CJ, sorry, shall we explain this to you? CJ is a big conglomerate that pretty much owns like, how much of a percentage of the media industry? Hannah, would you say?
I don't know the percentages, but I know like between them and Kakao, they basically, in the past we used to talk about the big three of K-pop. Now it's just Kakao and CJ.
And CJ doesn't even just own media, like they own cafes, they own like the supermarket. Like you go to the shops and there's like sauce packets with their brand stamp on it. And if I remember correctly, Parasite is a CJ CJ production. Parasite was like funded and pushed to be like not to take away from its from its quality or anything like that, because I think it's a great film, but like there was an active push to sort of like have that exposed to overseas and sold as an example of quality filmmaking. Lots of quality films in Japan exist, but that push to
Shoplifters, for example.
Sorry?
Like Shoplifters came out the year before Parasite. And like it won the Palme d'Or. Like Shoplifters won the Palme d'Or, but like it got some attention, but it wasn't pushed in the same way that like Parasite was the following year.
Yeah, and I think part of that as well is if you look at Shoplifters and Parasite, one has slightly more, like lots of people can watch Parasite without going in and analyzing all of the things in it and being like, wow, that was a crazy film. The same way that you can watch, for example, Squid Game and analyze it as a commentary on the cutthroat nature of society today. Or you can just watch it and be like, wow, that was fucked up. Sorry, wait, that was messed up.
You can take fuck on here. It's fine. I just
wanted to be careful. I know American censorship. Bad.
But have censorship.
Okay. Thank you. But yeah, the fact that it's you know, sellable on multiple levels. I think, you know what I think will like a good litmus test of that will be the new Kore-eda film is directed Koreeda, the guy who directed Shoplifters, his new film coming out is a Korean production.
Mm-hmm.
And the lead actress in that is somebody who has like incredible box office, like selling power.
Mm-hmm.
Like mainstream selling power. So it would be a good like look to see there, like, you know, the same act, the same director, but in two different markets and with two different like, what's it called? Like backing him and different names that he can play with. If that movie, which I'm sure will be just as like, you know, quiet and understated as all of his other films, if that movie manages to do much better internationally than Shoplifters did, then I think we can see like how much of a difference that marketing will be.
Well, one of the things too that they were talking about, because you talked about how Parasite was able just to go and like anyone could like go watch it and see this as this like this critique of capitalism. So one of the things they were talking about as far as Drive My Car is that like anyone could go and watch Drive My Car. This is the critics in Japan speaking. Anyone can go and watch Drive My Car and like understand it. But like most of our movies, you have to like be Japanese or like know about Japanese society to get our movies. And I'm like,
that is bullshit.
That's crap. Sorry. Okay. What about Parasite? That is actually... stupid. Like, what is it? What's the, oh God, what is it? The noodles. Hannah, help me. The noodles.
Oh.
Chapanku.
No, it's a
Chapanku.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the Chapaguri thing, right? And how there are all of these like thought articles out about it for ages and ages after. It's been like, here's the story behind Chapaguri. Here's why the beef was a representative of like it. I don't think it's all about marketing and the way you sell it.
Yeah, like okay, so let's also be completely frank, right? So CJ Kakao, very very important backstory to CJ is that it's actually a Samsung, like. The family that founded it, I believe, is a Samsung direct heir or something. But essentially, the reason why it's easier to make art film in Korea is literally because there's like three people you need to appeal to. And one of those three people is very, like, she loves art film. She loves it to death. And this woman is also like a Chaebol heiress, right?
Who is the woman?
I forget her name. She's like
because
one of the
I will say something because if she's related to the Samsungs, the Samsung family actually created the second largest museum of art in Korea.
Yeah. I think she's actually directly related to like the core Samsung family, which is super important because what do you need for an art film? You need a very, very rich sponsor who is not afraid to lose cash,
mm-hmm.
right? And you basically have this company that's just like, we don't care what we invest in because we know that these three films that all have like EXO or BTS in them are literally going to make back all of our money. And then on the other side, you literally have this woman being like, I will invest $15 million in your freaking movie and I don't care how much of it I see back, right? Like you have that and then you literally have a formalized network of how to cross collaborate between different companies with no explicit bans.
It's like a halo effect.
It's just like kind of a virtuous synergy of just three very, very coincidental factors that just happen to work in the right direction.
Because it's kind of like, even if it doesn't make us a lot of money, it still looks good on paper and it kind of like raises like the cultural cachet of our other products.
No, I wouldn't say that's actually very important. What's really important is that the Chaebol woman literally doesn't care about losing cash. She's just like, I want to see more art film. And they are like, okay, here are ideas. Give us cash.
Just to use like an example, so talking about like art film and how well it sells overseas and doesn't sell overseas, I was thinking about how like Parasite, a lot of it as well comes from things like social media effect and word of mouth being more strong than it was before and accessibility to foreign film being more open than it was before. Let's just look 10 years before. Have you seen Confessions?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Confessions is this movie from about 10 years ago in Japan, 2010. AKB that won. Sorry?
AKB was in it.
Do you know what? They were in it, yes. And then that's why, like, they made the beginner music video afterwards. But Confessions came out like 10 years ago. Very sleek, very bankable. It was, I think, in the top 10 movies grossing for Japan that year. And it won the Best Academy Award, and also very accessible. And if, for example, that movie had come out now, and if it had, you know, the media push that a movie like Parasite might have had now, I think it would do similarly well. And it's one of those movies that can be read on several levels as well. Like, is it just a messed up, psychopop portrayal, or is it like a commentary on something else? I don't think the quality of Japanese film has gone anywhere, really. I just think it's just the different films have come to the forefront, and there's just not enough of a...
There's just not enough pushing.
Yeah, but that's okay, because, too. I'm not...
Because Motoko Rich from the New York Times, and what is your BFF that you're always retweeting, Hannah? Hiroko Tanabuchi from the New York Times? What is her name, Hannah?
I think she's away from microphone. Ronald, it's Hiroko Tabauchi.
Yeah, I knew it was like Hiroko something. Well, she retweeted a Motoko Rich article, who she's the bureau chief. I think she's like the bureau chief for like the New York Times in Japan. And she was like talking about in her article about how because Japan has basically, in all forms of entertainment, has gone and isolated itself from the rest of the world, and kind of gone and isolated its taste, that like it can't really connect its products, its entertainment products, to the rest of the world. What do you think of that?
But I don't think that that's a valid statement with film, because there's always like, there's always going to be trash films no matter what the market, and there's always going to be good films no matter what the market. It's not a case of like our film industry is the culprit or not. It's just about like where are we going to give the exposure to and where are we going to push it forwards. And I think it's also really easy to look at other markets and be like, oh, their market is so much better than ours. But like, there are many terrible movies from other Asian countries that come out every year. That have like lots of exposure that we as a Western English based market might not know much about, but those are the films that are selling, for example, in Southeast Asian markets and stuff. Right. And those are the films that my Korean friends are going to watch when they release them over here, because they're like highest grossing overseas. What was the highest grossing Korean film? Wasn't it Exit recently before Parasite? Hang on, let me look this up. Because I watched Exit and it wasn't like particularly smart or anything, but it was, hang on, give me 2 seconds.
Who was in it that made people want to watch it?
You're not from Sonyeoside.
Oh God. So the thing is though, I will say like a little thing about her is that like on my old forum, like 10 years ago, someone actually found a performance of them doing a song at SM Town in New York. And they actually like somehow found video of me looking at Yuna and making like a stank face and then like turning my head.
Why would you do that? She's so pretty.
She's not pretty. She's very plain looking.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Here we go.
Here we go again.
Here we go. Which one of the girls' generation then, Ronald? Which one?
Soo Young.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yep. Yes. I can get on board with that.
Followed by Hyoyeon.
Yes. Yes. But yeah, that's other questions regarding like idol group centers and relatability and mass marketability.
We won't get it. Hannah, question. Did you, okay, because you're always, you're the lady here. Did you think the movie was misogynistic?
Yes and no, right? It can't escape from Murakami, is the answer that I give. Because it's very obvious that, like, for example, in the first 40 minutes, I just had to be like, I'm going to play TFT in the background while I fucking watch this shit because this is annoying, right? But after that, it actually gets pretty good. So that's what I mean by yes and no.
And a question for both of you, since you two are Asian, what did you guys think of the kind of like pan-Asian representation inside of the movie?
I mean, I don't think it was necessarily... because all of the pan-Asian characters in the film were like from other countries, like I don't really think it was representation in that. Like, let's say if I was a Japanese national, right? And I'd watch that movie and I'd be like, oh, I'm looking for representation of me as a Filipino person living in Japan or something along those lines. There wasn't really anything of that because it was just like, they were actors that were from a different country performing in Japan. I wouldn't really count it as representation one way or another. Maybe.
Kind of like, oh, go ahead.
No, nothing. Go.
Oh, because I was going to say like, I don't really even know that it was significant beyond like communication is important and communication can just happen anywhere.
It was like the most base of like symbols in a film.
Because in fact,
when I think about it, you know, the hearing impaired character, I'm not sure like the hearing impairedness like contributed that much to the film other than that specific symbol of like communication is important. And also maybe to drive home the emotional impact of that scene at the very end where she is doing the monologue as part of the Uncle Vanya play.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really think it was. I don't think representation is a big part of this movie's particular.
Yeah.
I was just asking because I saw it there, because there was like one little part that was kind of just like, oh, that's a bit messy. Because like some of the older Japanese actors, they were just like, I like this. But the thing is, though, is that sometimes I get confused when I hear foreign languages and it's like, ha, ha, ha. Yeah, me too.
Oh, yeah, in the film. Oh, no, I do remember that. But I didn't think that was like particularly supposed to be a moment for people in the audience to be like, yeah, other languages are weird. Like, I don't think that was an appeal moment to the audience. I think
kind of I grimaced a bit. I was like, because maybe, like the Taiwanese actors was like sitting right there where she couldn't understand them.
Yeah, maybe to drive home that like sort of not understanding people who are right in front of you and not having, you know, understanding not just of the words, but understanding of the heart. You know, that sounds quite like flowery language, but I think you know what I mean.
Well, the thing is, though, if there was better communication between Oto and Yusuke, their marriage would have not been so the way it was. Communication is key.
I have a question to ask because there was one opinion that I was reading about online that did not like click with me, and I wanted to see what you guys thought of this. The scene that's considered to be like the strongest scene in the movie is the scene where Okada Masaki, who plays the junior actor, is in the back of the car with the main character, whose name I forgot. And he has that monologue where he talks about his experience with the main character's deceased wife. And it's a very long and sustained monologue, and people have praised him for his acting and praised the writing in that section particularly as well. I wanted to ask, Hannah, did you get up to that part in the movie? No. Yes?
I was half paying attention.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, we will interject. This scene comes minutes after he has attacked someone that took his photo and the person ends up dying.
Yes.
So he just murdered somebody essentially. And then he does this scene.
Yes. What did you think of the scene, Ronald?
I thought it was nice, but I also was kind of like, I felt bad for Yusuke. That he was having to hear about, like, because he thought that he had this big intimate moment with his wife, but then he was just like, oh, I heard that story too, but you didn't hear the end of it like I did.
And explain the rest of it, right? Yeah. I watched it and I thought that in terms of like where it fit in the overall plot as, like, yes, it serves its purpose, etc. But it was interesting reading all of the opinions about that being the strong point of the film, because I watched that and I thought that was actually, maybe it's because by this point it was 2 hours and a half into the movie and I was very tired and full of snacks. And my attention span was kind of flagging at this point. But I watched it and I was like, oh, I don't really think that that's like an effective storytelling tool for this particular context. Like, it's very Japanese in that. One of the things that Japanese media tends to do, whether it's like anime or film or TV, is that it tells instead of shows. And it's just like, that exposition dump. Let me just like, here are all of these things you didn't know about the storyline. We're just going to tell you in like rapid fire. And you're just going to take it on board without us actually including any nuance in it. And so that's what I kind of felt watching that part, because it was just like, here's all of this information withheld from you, also not foreshadowed. We're just going to give it to you right now. Mm-hmm. And then people also gave Okada Masaki a lot of praise for his acting in that section. I was like, oh, Okada Masaki can act a bit more than I thought he could. But I wasn't necessarily blown away by that section. I was wondering if it was a me problem or what you guys thought about that scene.
I found his character in general to be kind of like, I feel like he was playing a more famous version of someone, of one of his peers.
Yes. And that is actually very interesting that you said that. Well, I will talk about that in a second. which actor does it remind you of, Ronald?
I'm not going to name any particular names, but like the
you
whole
you should thing, name it, coward.
Yeah, because it's really important, actually.
Yes.
Yes. I like went back and I thought about like Hamaguchi's work, I was like, huh, who was it?
I don't have anyone in mind, but you coward. Name somebody. Who do you think?
Hannah, do you have someone in mind?
No, I was just thinking about like, when somebody dies after when the paparazzi person dies, I'm just like, wait, this reminds me of like a bunch
it
of
wasn't a paparazzi people. Person it was literally
just random. Yeah,
it was just a random person. I was probably trying to sell that photo because it was he was using like a phone camera, not like an actual real camera. But the other thing
like,
too,
but that happens a lot too with like just like people who are like paparazzi adjacent. Do that
yeah.
a lot.
Like, I think about that story that I wrote about Yamashita Tomohisa taking that girl's phone and like breaking
it. Or the snowman guy.
No, that is completely, that is not related at all.
When I was watching the film, when I think because the storyline of that character is that, you know, he gets into a really big scandal and pretty much gets ousted out of his.
He's caught sleeping with a minor.
And he's sort of like walking around with like a scarlet letter on his back and with all of these people, you know, prying into his private life and stuff. I don't think it was intentional, but I thought it was like a funny coincidence because it reminded me of Higashida Masahiro, who cheated on his wife. Yeah. And then, pretty much was like ousted out of the industry after several attempts to like redeem himself. And do you know who played the male wallpaper in Asako 1 and 2?
Wait, was it him?
Yes, it was him.
Oh my God.
That's why I was like, I don't think this was on purpose, like intentionally, but also it's all I can think of because he worked with you as well. And you must be like quite intimately familiar with this story because you, in a way, Hamaguchi, have unintentionally caused like this scandal to happen through your casting of those two people.
Well, get ready to see more of him because you know what he's supposed to be doing now.
He got there? What's he doing?
Yeah. He's supposed to be adapting Yukio Mishima books to turn into movies for the Western market.
Goodbye.
The international market.
I will remember you for Kirishima and nothing else.
Like,
Kirishima
yeah,
was a great movie. That should have been sold overseas. I love that movie.
Just so many missed chances.
But
there are lots of great
Japanese
movies. I don't know what people are talking. There is the one problem, however, with quality Japanese filmmaking is that it's all based around the same five directors. And that is like a fair
that's
thing.
Very cute.
People have complained about, like, you know, younger directors can't get anything off the runway because it's all like name basis level. But also I would argue that maybe that's like less of a Japan only problem and more of a like
international art film problem, because Korea and China are also the same exact boat.
The same thing. Yeah. It's like the same 3-4 directors over and over again.
Yeah. Like Korea, sure, you know, Korea's like even smaller than Japan, maybe there might be a point, but like you're really telling me that 1.3 billion people can only churn out 3 quality directors? That's complete cap.
I think that's an industry
problem. Instead.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys, do you guys have any final thoughts on Drive My Car?
The What Did You Eat Yesterday movie comes out on DVD this month.
The
What Did You Eat Yesterday movie comes out next month, I think, on DVD, which means it will be findable for us online. Wink, wink. Everyone should check that out if you like the lead actor from Drive My Car. Do you know what this is, Ronald? What Did You Eat Yesterday?
I don't think I do.
Maybe you should watch it. It's about like a gay lawyer and his live-in boyfriend, and like it's just their day-to-day life. And the gay lawyer is played by Nishijima from Drive My Car.
Is it a BL? Like,
no, yes, it's not.
It's BL. Okay.
It's BL adjacent, like, but like it's not BL the way you hate BL. It's like it's much more palatable.
The thing is, though, is that I watched a movie last year and you guys were just like, it's BL. And I was just like, it's about like a divorcee fighting for custody of his daughter with his like boyfriend. And they're like, it's BL. I'm like, not everything is straight up BL.
Wait, what movie was that?
His with
that's BL. That's BL. Sorry.
Because she has gone back and forth, said like, "Oh, that's not BL. Oh, it is BL." So now today it's a BL movie.
Okay. Well, it's okay. So there's different kinds of like boys love. There's the ones that are like very specifically like fetishistic and like not examples of any real life things at all, and then there are ones that I really enjoy that fall into the category of like maybe it started off from being in that place, but the creators are very earnest in creating genuine representations and addressing real life issues. So the one that you watched, Ronald, and the one that I'm recommending right now, What Did You Eat Yesterday, are ones that fall into that second category.
So what is actually like a real gay movie?
What you watched?
What do you mean?
As in, like that's a fine representation. It's fine, right? Like,
you know, like an actual like non BL gay.
But then, okay, I don't think gay movies should be a genre at all. Anyway, like the way that we think of like gay movies, like when you put it like quote unquote gay movies,
the genre,
you think of like the LGBT section on Amazon Prime, which is all like about. Like
GBF.
GBF or like four single Italian men go on a road trip and discover themselves and each other's
voice. Oh my god. Your country made like one of the most famous gay movies of all time.
Holding the Man?
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
What's that? Oh no, yeah. Yeah, okay. Or like stuff like that. Things that are like, it depends. Do you only count it as a gay movie if it's like in caps sparkles gay, or is it a gay movie as long as it's like incidentally gay with LGBT characters but not necessarily about like hashtag issues?
It has to be, well, the gay characters have to be central to the movie.
Yes,
like the characters have to be the main characters. It can't be like a side character.
Yes. So in that situation, then all of the movies that we have listed today, and including most BL media, would, I guess, technically count as gay movies. But I think for some people, the question of where the representation comes from is very important. So, like, you know, is this a genuine representation, or is this like, did somebody who is not related to the community at all sort of like dream up an idea in their head of what gay people are like, and then made the media based off of that? Right.
By the way, this part is going to be edited out because it's like it's not pertinent to the conversation. But we can still
keep very pertinent to the conversation.
Yeah, no, I kind of agree with that.
Like as far as like drive my car.
Yes, because okay. So let me explain why it's super pertinent, right? Drive My Car is a quote unquote art house film, right? And it's big sparkly letters, art house. It's super understated.
It's 3 hours long. It's very quiet.
It's like,
do you think 3 years long?
3 hours. 3 hours.
I thought you said 3 years long.
Lols. But yeah, like, I don't know. There's this need to compartmentalize movies, and it just is annoying.
People like compartments, Hannah.
Stop! I am literally gonna go find you.
I love boxes. I love compartments. I love organization.
Sorry, no, but like, what are we talking about now?
But like the compartment of BL film.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Like that to me is just it's just a like, why do you confine yourself to a compartment?
Why do I confine myself to a compartment?
No, like all these directors, right? They just box themselves in and go like, I can't move outside of this box.
Well, it's more like, so Ronald just now is like, I love compartmenting things in organization. I think most people do like compartmentalizing things.
Like what he just spoke about, when people like say like, oh, I'm gay. I want to watch a gay movie. What am I going to do? Go to the LGBT section on Netflix.
Yeah. But I think that's the question of like BL, especially in like live action media now, is I think it is like slightly more nuanced now than it was 15 years ago in a way that like, I was not like into any sort of that MLM media pumped out by Japan for ages, because it was all like really distasteful stuff like that. And what's that one with the, you know, stuff with like students fall in love with high school teachers and it's all very awkward and all very like, this is all fantasy.
Yeah.
But nowadays, even stuff that fall within the BL category, like I saw this one recently that was about a man moving back out to his hometown country, and then he falls in love with, like, you know, the local country bumpkin. And I was like, this is fine. Like, there's no weird gender roles being imposed upon these characters. There's no, like, expectations. It is just, like, an incidental story about romance and love in which both lead characters are male. And because I think when we say like LGBT movies and like movies for gay people, like there's this sort of like understanding that like, or maybe it's a misconception that like male audiences or like gay male audiences don't like straight romance. Like it's always got to have like sex in it or something gritty in it, like somebody dies of like HIV or something like that. So I found that like in order to watch like content that was generally, you know, fluffy and benign, I would really not have much option but to watch BL adjacent media, because it's either that or four gay Italian men go on a road trip.
Speaking of sex in movies, so recently there has been a whole like, there's been a bunch of think pieces about how like movies nowadays are quite sexless. How movies now don't have sex scenes like they did back in like the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. So funny enough, they were talking about how none of the movies that are nominated for Best Picture this past year at the Oscars had a sex scene in them, except for Drive My Car. So what are your guys' final thoughts on Drive My Car? Tim, our guest.
Good, decent movie. Bit too long.
It's funny because one of Hamaguchi's mentors at the movie was just okay.
Which mentor?
I don't know. I read a story in the Motoko Rich article. And then the New York Times, they were just like, oh, one of his mentors at university was just like, oh, it was an okay film.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? I think I'll have more understanding of the movie once I watch his other films. Because I haven't actually seen Wheel of Fortune and I haven't actually seen Asaka 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Same. I think once I have a more of an understanding of who Hamaguchi is as an artist, I think I'd have a better understanding of Drive My Car.
Continue your thoughts on Drive My Car, though.
Nishijima, very handsome. Watch the What Did You Eat Yesterday movie, please.
Please.
Yeah.
Or he's very a gay handsome. Lawyer.
Yeah, he is. And I was going through my photos from like past vacations recently, and I found like an entire stack of when I just went into Yodobashi camera and went up and down the escalators to take all the photos of him advertising appliances on the wall.
Oh my God.
I would do the same thing. So
not that like that giggle. I'm glad we have that on tape.
What giggle?
That would be the new Love Aiko.
Love Aiko. The movie was fine.
Hannah.
Hang on. What did I give it in Letterboxd? Give me a second.
Not Letterboxd. Not the Rate Your really Music of Cinema.
I should really start using that again.
I gave it an eight.
That's kind of high.
No, eight is like, so it's like 4 stars, right? So 3.5 is around like the, well, it was fine. And then 8 is like, 4 stars is about the level of like, I can see its technical like goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And also maybe it wasn't like my favorite.
What would you give a 10 so we can judge?
Everything Everywhere All at Once.
I need to watch.
Everyone needs to watch Everything Everywhere All at Once. Ronald, you need to watch it. And then you need to come back here and tell us your opinions on it. Because I'm fairly sure it would be very entertaining to hear.
The one thing I'm hearing about it is that it's very good. They should have released it during Christmas of last year or this year.
I mean, I don't know. We get movies like one.
It gets a better chance at Oscar buzz that way.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Hannah, what were your thoughts?
I'm actually very surprised that Tim would give it an 8, because usually for just technical ability only, I would only say it's a 6.
No, you have to think about it as letter grades. An 8 is a B.
You think it's a B? I think for somebody who's as talented as Hamaguchi is, you know that feeling that you have when you have such a talented student that you're just like, for any other student, this is a B effort. But for you, it is.
Have you seen his other movies though? We haven't seen his other movies.
But I've seen like snippets of it, and I'm just like, I actually think my letter grade might actually drop.
Watching
these
other stuff. So Hannah,
I have to hand it to him because he made Nishijima a good actor for 3 hours, and he's not a good actor.
So why do you like him if he's not a good actor?
I don't know, Ronald. Why do you buy the Snowman CDs?
Yeah, that.
Oh my God. By the way, I'm considering translating an article that came out today on Real Sound, and it's like, Iwamoto Hikaru, rapper, singer, dancer.
I hate this.
I'm off tomorrow. I'm off the next 2 days, so I'm considering translating it.
Somebody DDoS Ronald right now.
I mean, everyone's free to be an otaku.
I guess so.
Hannah, what is a 10 movie for you, just so we can judge your scale?
A 10 movie. It changes based on how I feel, but it's the last 10 movie. I'm gonna have to think. Like, let's see. I don't know. It's actually really hard to think of one like straight up. Oh, The Handmaiden.
Oh, really that was good.
Or like Wailing. I really, really liked Wailing.
Wailing? What's Wailing?
Koksung. It's a Korean. It's another Korean.
Is that, that's the Squid Game director, hey?
Oh, wait, really?
Wait, isn't it? Isn't that the one with like the school?
Oh, no, 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 that's Crucible. I like that one, but I wouldn't give it a 10.
Koksung.
Okay, what did I think of it? I really enjoyed it. Like, the thing is, though, is that, like, when I was looking at the movie, there are certain parts of the movie where I look at it, and it's just, like, very, like, beautiful to look at. Like, there's this one particular shot that gets to me where it's kind of just, like, where there's, like, where you see the back of the ferry in the night. Like, mm-hmm. that one part is, like, really, like, burned into my head. And I think of like a photographer like Takashi Homma or this other new photographer that I really like named Fumi Ishino. And I think of like their work with like portraits or like still life. And I think of that and I'm just like, oh, it reminded me of that. That was like really nice. Like the saturation of color, the use of like light and shadow. It was really good. What would I give the movie? I would give the movie an 8. I think it's an 8, a solid 8.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
A 10 movie for me. You guys do not want to know what a 10 movie for me is because I think the thing is, it was, oh my God. One of my two of my favorite movies of all time, I would give 10s to.
Which ones?
Well, one was already named tonight.
Wait, what
was
that?
Is it going to be Showgirls?
Showgirls is my favorite movie of all time.
Okay, but that's like a U 10. As opposed to like, this is a universal rating scale 10.
Okay. So you just said Wailing. Was that considered a good movie?
Yeah, that was internationally acclaimed.
Wait, what did Tim say was his 10?
Everything Everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah. That's also internationally acclaimed.
Do I like internationally acclaimed movies?
I like Melancholia. Okay,
I would say just like, I would say like if I was to give like a 10 to a movie that's internationally acclaimed, probably like Belle de Jour.
Didn't watch that one, so I don't
know. I don't know what that is.
Louis Buñuel, Catherine Deneuve, 60s.
What's the movie?
Belle de Jour. Catherine Deneuve plays a bourgeoisie housewife. She is the wife of a doctor, and she's frigid. And so, basically, she tries to overcome her frigid nature by becoming a prostitute during the day. Hence the name Belle du Jour.
My other five, one of my other 10 out of 10s is the Catherine Deneuve movie.
Which one?
Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Why are my favorite movies all about sex workers?
That's a good question.
Showgirls.
That's a very good question.
Belle du Jour, American Gigolo. Oh.
And with that.
Yep. Okay. Any last words? Okay. Well, me and Hannah are going to continue the movie conversation. But Tim, thank you for coming tonight. Yes. Do you have last words?
I do. Did you know that acclaimed city pop idol group Especia are reuniting for a one-off concert
at that venue in Osaka that has like the light wall?
Oh, is it? Korea? No, it's not. Especia are reuniting for a concert on the 18th of June at 12:30 p.m. Japan time. It's being live streamed on YouTube. I think the girls and the fan base would really appreciate it if as many people as possible showed up on the live stream and watched it. I know that there are many Especia fans on the Arama website. It's a good way to say goodbye. Or maybe hello. We don't know what will happen after.
Hopefully hello.
Hopefully. I think it would be hello, because how long were they inactive for?
Years. It's been a while.
Five years. 5 years, says my source.
Your source.
Yeah, 5 years. Exactly 5 years? Is anyone opening for them? No. There's going to be three of the original members. And then two members who have just had children may or may not make a special appearance. We don't know yet.
Is Yukika going to be there?
Yukika is with child right now.
She is?
Yes, she's really following in the footsteps of those 1980s idols.
Oh, so that's why I haven't heard about her recently.
Yeah, it like happened yesterday. She was like, I'm not gonna, what's, oh, and she's married. She's married and she's, isn't she pregnant? No, she's not pregnant. She's just married. Look, it doesn't matter anyway. We're not going to talk about Yukika right now. You should be talking about Kesha
and the reunion concert
next week, next month.
Well, Tim, once again, thank you for coming. Thank you for being a friend of the show.
No
problem.
No worries. See you later.
Bye. We're going to continue though, Hannah.
Wait, what?
Yes.